You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Open Road by Rita Omoka, with photos by Annie Leibovitz. The night before the mob of Trumpists tried to overthrow democracy, some House members texted one another in their group chat, concerned. Don't underestimate, because many of them will see this as their last stand, Demings replied at one point. As she arrived at the Capitol that Wednesday morning, she was surprised there wasn't more law enforcement present. In the demonstrations she had worked during her time in uniform, she'd learned that a show of force often discourages unruly acts. Like, if you want to cut the fool here, don't do it, because we're here with our helmets and riot gear on, she said. We've increased our authorized strength. Don't do it. Shortly after proceedings to certify Biden's election win began, there was commotion outside the House gallery. Demings, sitting in the front row, flashed back to her days on the force. Instinct kicked in. She got up and stood guard by the door, arms crossed in front of her body. Moments later, the sergeant-at-arms ran down the center aisle, repeating, "There's been a breach." When Demings heard breach, her mindset shifted. When there's a demonstration, she told me, there's an outer perimeter and an inner perimeter, and people might get through the outer perimeter, but nobody gets through the inner perimeter. I knew if there had been a breach of the building that the police had lost whatever battle they were in. Ruckus ensued. Glass started to break. Soon the Capitol filled with eerie howls as the pack bounded down the halls. Capitol police officers frantically pushed furniture against doors. Rioters pounded harder, trying to break through. Capitol police began evacuating the House floor. They told those in the gallery to get down, get your gas mask, because we might need to deploy gas, Demings said, still flashing back. And here I am. I'm thinking, wait a minute, wait a minute. I spent 27 years on the streets of Orlando. I have chased people through backyards and alleys and all those traffic stops, which can be the most dangerous because many times you don't know who you're stopping, and all those domestic violence calls, which are extremely dangerous. And I'm in the House of Representatives. Her widened eyes stayed on me a beat longer, no blinks. And I remember looking down at my waist. No gun. I never felt as vulnerable as I did that day, because on the street you have all your weapons. You have your vest on. You're prepared for that. I'm in the Capitol in my suit and my high heels. As the attack escalated, Representative Jason Crow, a fellow impeachment manager alongside Demings during Trump's first trial, told everyone to take off their congressional pins. He later told Demings they should have walked over to the GOP side. Representative Lisa Blunt Rochester and Demings spread out on the floor next to each other, gas mask on. Rochester stared at Demings and said, "Val, what do you think is going to happen?" "Lisa, I'm not sure what's going to happen," Demings told her, "but if we all died today, if we are who we say we are as a nation, if we are as big and bad as we say we are, then another group will just come in and certify these electoral ballots, declaring Joe Biden as the president and Kamala Harris as the vice president. If America is as bad, if our spirit and determination is what I believe it is, they might stop us, but they can't stop this process." She told me point blank, if she had to die that day, she was ready. Because I went to a job every day where I knew that I might not go back home. Demings then told Rochester to pray and remembered thinking, The rest was like, it's in God's hands. The entire time, Jerry had been blowing up Deming's phone. When he finally reached her, she was blazing up with anger. I was reminding her, you've been through this stuff before, Jerry said. You can't do your best thinking when you're angry. You have to take control of the situation and think through it. But she was in police mode at that point, on behalf of her colleagues, who have never been in a high-risk situation, had never been shot at, and had never been in a shooting. Capitol Police finally escorted Demings and her colleagues to safety through a tunnel they'd never seen before. Reflecting on that day, after a campaign stop in Gainesville, she told me there's an urgent need to safeguard democracy. There's always been a lot of focus on our adversaries around the world, she said. But in every oath that I've taken, it talks about protect against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I don't believe that there is any foreign power out there that can take our country down. I think we can only do it from within. Since John Lewis died in July 2020, Demings has watched the right speak of the civil rights giant's formidable legacy while dishonoring his lifelong fight for voting rights. Her Senate run, instead of the race she initially considered to challenge Governor Ron DeSantis, owes to the man Lewis was. When the House passed the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, and it was sent to Mitch McConnell's legislative graveyard in the Senate, where bills go to die, that was the tipping point for me, Demings said. She'd also been watching the manufactured culture wars and subjugating GOP-backed bills emanating from Florida, restricting mail-in voting, creating election policing, passing the anti-LGBTQ+, don't say gay bill, making abortion all but illegal. Meanwhile, there were key pieces of legislation going to the Senate to die. The George Floyd Policing Act, the Violence Against Women Act, and immigration reform. Put together, these developments convinced Demings that, yeah, we need to make Florida better. But in the Senate, we can make America better. And if we make America better, then Florida and 49 other states are better. In recent years, Florida's political leanings have been murky, which gives the Demings campaign hope. There was Andrew Gillum's narrow loss to DeSantis in the 2018 governor's race. Before that, in the 2014 gubernatorial matchup, Charlie Crist lost by 1 percentage point to Rick Scott, who then went on to barely defeat, by 10,000 votes after 2 recounts, Senate incumbent Bill Nelson in 2018. Still, Demings is keenly aware of the challenges ahead, including the Latino electorate. In 2020, more Latino voters in Florida supported Trump than in 2016, almost doubling in some counties, with a higher-than-usual percentage of Cuban Americans backing him. Rubio, a son of Cuban immigrants, benefits from this, but he's still vulnerable. He's going to have a hard time attacking Val Demings and campaigning in the traditional way, political scientist Sean Foreman of Florida's Barry University told me. He called Demings a star within her party, genuinely likable and electable, who has a winning shot. He also had some words of caution. Republicans won in Florida last time by calling Democrats socialist. Demings has got to counter that attack early on, defining herself before they define her. Especially with the pervasiveness of Trumpism, Biden's abysmal approval rating, and history not being on the Dem side as the incumbent party. On the trail, Demings has already been playing some fierce offense. Besides Rubio's history of flip-flopping on policy and numerous scandals, she's been calling out some of his delinquencies, like letting Floridians know he voted against COVID assistance for families, and that he supports overturning Roe v. Wade. He introduced a bill to penalize companies like Amazon and Apple that have promised to reimburse employees' abortion travel in a post-Roe world. though recent polls show most of the state's constituents oppose abortion bans. Demings has also been pointing to Rubio's neglect, telling voters he doesn't show up for them in the literal sense. Marco Rubio has one of the worst attendance records in the United States. Of roll call votes in the Senate, he has missed more than 330 out of roughly 3,650, the fewest appearances of any Florida senator in more than 50 years. The median among lifetime voting absences for currently serving senators is 2.2%. Rubio comes close to 10%. He was also absent from Biden's first State of the Union address, citing COVID testing requirements. But Floridians know Rubio. Demings has less than half of his 95% name ID record in the state, she told me. Despite that polling, like February's Mason-Dixon survey, has the two-term senator's support under 50%. To Demings, that's a sign people are open to an alternative. I've just got to make sure I have the resources to be able to communicate in a state with 67 counties and 21 million people. Foreman, the political scientist, sees that as precisely her weakness. She needs to be doing more in South Florida to be known, he said, because the people who watch cable TV, they know her. But like the regular voters, primary voters, I don't think know her. Stephanie Brown James of the Collective PAC said it would take grassroots efforts to boost voter awareness of Demings. Her team backed Gillum's 2018 gubernatorial run against DeSantis, a defeat she called devastating because it underscored that no voter can be left behind, and there is always a need to reach one more person. Because Florida remains a microcosm of America, James has advised Demings not to overlook crafting distinct approaches for communities that tend to be viewed as monolithic, like the Latino and Black communities, while forming strategies to get young voters engaged on issues they care about, such as student loans and fair policing. James's strategy for Demings to target the Latino electorate, a demographic with which she's most vulnerable against Rubio, and one where Biden's popularity keeps dropping, is to distinguish herself from the current Democratic brand tied to socialism with an issues-first approach that resonates with a diverse community. That means immigration reform, access to health care, including reproductive rights, child care, paid family leave, and educational and career opportunities, where you don't have to work three or four jobs in order to pay your bills, James said. Also, they've been pushing the fact that Demings has championed criminal justice reform in a way that is real and inclusive of community engagement. And although it stalled, letting voters know she has been one of the biggest supporters of the Build Back Better plan, Biden's signature bill that Rubio voted against, calling it Build Back Socialist, relying on a talking point that particularly resonates with Cuban Americans who are more conservative and susceptible to GOP anti-socialist messaging, while leaning into the Republican tactic of a tried and tested path to victory that revolves around hot-button issues, critical race theory, Disney, book bans, the big lie, etc., stoking it every which way to incite panic among their base. Then there's the matter of money. Historically, Black women are three times more likely to be outraised than any other demographic that they may run against, especially white women, James said from her experience on various campaigns, including Stacey Abrams' current gubernatorial run in Georgia and Charles Booker's bid to unseat Kentucky Senator Rand Paul. But Demings and her team told me she has donors statewide, and from the other 49 states, averaging $26 in contributions. After announcing her run last June, Demings raised $4.6 million to Rubio's $4 million in the first quarter, a statewide record of $8.4 million by the third quarter, followed by a shattering $10 million to Rubio's $5.8 million at the top of this year. All said, her campaign has averaged $8 million a quarter, cementing her as Rubio's foremost challenger ahead of the August primaries. Veteran Democratic strategist James Carville has called Deming's fight to unseat Rubio one to watch, saying her momentum is building. Perspective is what Deming says she'd bring to the Senate. She likened it to the weight borne by recently appointed Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. When I heard that she was the first Supreme Court justice who had served as a public defender, so none of the others know what it's like to represent poor people and hear their experiences, Deming questioned. The perspective that she brings to the bench is so desperately needed. It's not one limited to race either, she said, calling out Justice Clarence Thomas. He's not looking out for me and my children and grandchildren. It's bigger than color. It's bigger than party. In Jackson, we have another Thurgood Marshall. This is important. One afternoon, our conversation on representation drifted to Harris, who has since become a public incarnation of the hurdles women of color must still overcome, even when they get to the proverbial table. That you can be the smartest, the brightest, but when you walk in a room, people got to get past your black face, she said, because just by that, there are certain beliefs about who you are. And though Deming doesn't invoke race much, she understands firsthand how stereotypes stacked against black women influence presumptions of what we can and cannot do. Those perceptions win and lose elections. And Val, there's hope. Representative Robin Kelly said of her longtime friend and colleague's campaign that we can move closer to that promise of America. Deming's life is also a story of success. Her Delta sorority sister, Representative Joyce Beatty, told me she understands multiple systems and how to work through them without ever foregoing on her principles. It's the power within her. If successful, Deming will become the only active black female senator and third ever in its 233 years behind Carol Moseley Brown and Harris. It took 24 years from Braun's election to Harris's win. She will also be the second woman elected to the Senate from Florida since Paula Hawkins in 1980. Records aside, this run is the most consequential assignment Demings has been ready to complete. Oprah talks a lot about that aha moment, she said. When we think about that, we think it's really big and powerful, but it's usually not. It's just that quiet moment that tugs at the heart. And John Lewis, his legislation, now he's gone. But now we are the guardians of what he died for, risked his life for. So we got to continue to do that. If not us, then who? When I make it to the U.S. Senate, it will not be the same. on the House. As Christian Dior celebrates 75 years and a sparkling new house museum, creative director Maria Grazia Turi and others take stock of the lasting influence of its founder by Leah Fay Cooper. Opening photo, models prepare in the booth ahead of a 1960 Dior fashion show. And next photos, couturier Christian Dior stands before the brand's ancestral home at 30 Avenue Montaigne in 1949. The diorama houses 1,874 items, including 452 miniature dress replicas created over the course of 6 months. The first time Swazik Pfaff set foot in La Galerie Dior, the Paris museum dedicated to the French luxury house, she cried a little bit because it was so important. Pfaff joined Dior in 1974 as an assistant in the licensing department, and in the nearly half-century since has become director of Dior Heritage, overseeing the brand archives. They succeeded in the architecture, she says, from a corner booth in the gallery's cafe, her eyes welling. And it was what Mr. Dior, I'm sure, he wanted. I'm still emotional. The gallery, which opened to the public in the spring, occupies the same address as Dior's original boutique and atelier, 30 Avenue Montaigne in the 8th arrondissement, and is a monumental destination for the house, which celebrates its 75th anniversary this year. Such longevity is a notable achievement for any brand, but especially so for Dior, given that its founder, Christian Dior, died just 10 years after launching his eponymous label. The first Dior collection in 1947 had a tremendous impact, says creative director Maria Grazia Turi. The original couturier's designs, Turi notes, were instrumental in helping French fashion reclaim its rightful center spot following World War II, which ravaged the previously thriving industry. Famously coined the new look by then Harper's Bazaar editor-in-chief Carmel Snow, it was marked by full skirts, cinched waist silhouettes, and rounded shoulders, a stark departure from more practical wartime dressing. 75 years later, with Turi as the first woman at the helm of Dior women's and couture collections, Kim Jones as creative director of menswear, and Victoire de Castellane overseeing fine jewelry, it remains one of the world's most influential luxury brands and labels. Turi and Pfaff attribute much of this success to the brand's commitment to its heritage, which chairman and CEO Pietro Beccari reaffirmed with the opening of La Galerie Dior and a revamp of the adjoining flagship boutique. Born in Normandy in 1905 and later raised in Paris, Christian Dior came from a wealthy family supported by his father's successful fertilizer business. His parents wanted him to be a diplomat, says Helene Starkman, the longtime cultural projects manager and exhibitions curator. They pressured him to study political science, but he never graduated. Dior Père gave his son money to open an art gallery under the condition that it wouldn't bear the Dior name. That, his parents believed, would be gauche. When Dior was forced to close the gallery in 1931, following the collapse of his father's business, he became an illustrator and then an assistant to designer Robert Piguet. After his stint in the French military, he returned to assistant life, this time under Lucien Lelong. Dior was approached by textile manufacturer Marcel Boussat in 1946 to revive the Philippe et Gaston brand. Dior had something else in mind. According to Starkman, he told Boussat, "You want to reopen a house that was open before the war, but I don't think it's relevant today. It's 1946. The war is over. We have to appeal to people who are starting a new life after the war." The argument was convincing. and the two opened the Christian Dior offices and atelier at 30 Montaigne. There, on February 12, 1947, Dior presented his first collection to the press and select members of high society. 95 looks that included Dior's now iconic bar suit, consisting of an hourglass silhouetted cream jacket and a pleated A-line skirt. The success was immediate, and by 1953, the couturier was exhibiting his collections abroad, designing costumes for Hollywood films, and had opened boutiques in New York and Caracas. In a way, Christian Dior never wanted to become Christian Dior, Starkman says. He wanted to be open only for a few clients, the richest of them and the most sophisticated of them, she adds, noting the expense of his garments due to the use of luxury fabrics and each piece being made to measure. He didn't mean to become a household name, but he did. When Dior died unexpectedly at 52 in 1957, he left behind an identity that allowed the company and his predecessors to thrive. Yves Saint Laurent, Marc Bohan, Gianfranco Ferré, Gian Galliano, and Raph Simons successively filled the creative director role, then Thiery in 2016. I think a lot of people don't realize how focused and how business-oriented he was, Starkman says of the late designer. If he hadn't been like that, there would probably not be a House of Dior 75 years later, you know. By the time LVMH head Bernard Arnault purchased Dior in 1984, the brand had expanded to include ready-to-wear, menswear, and children's clothes, as well as a cosmetics line. One of Arnault's first big ventures was organizing a house retrospective at the Musée des Arts Décoratifs in Paris to mark the brand's 40th anniversary in 1987. A small team was assembled to locate garments and documents for the exhibit, and shortly afterward, the archives department was established. Pfaff took over the department in 1996. I arrived there 3 weeks before Galliano, she says. I learned with him. We learned together. Pfaff and her team pursue various avenues to locate archival pieces. Many are found and bought at auctions or acquired from museums. Some, like the Junon gown from Dior's fall-winter 1949 to 1950 collection, are obtained by referencing the designer's extensive client records and contacting those families. That dress, we bought it back from the family of a woman named Mrs. Newman from Florida, Pfaff says. She died quite young, and her husband organized an auction with all the garments she bought from Dior, and also accessories. Of course, we bought everything. It's really madness that led us to propose this, Beccari says of La Galerie Dior, which the house conceived in 2018. His goal, he explains, was to create a fantastic point of uniqueness for the Dior brand in Paris, something that couldn't be replicated. It took courage to go to Monsieur Arnault, he notes, of the project, which required Dior to close the flagship boutique, offices, and atelier occupying 30 Montaigne for more than 2 years. The brand tapped longtime collaborator Peter Marino for the architecture. Natalie Crinière, who has designed several past Dior exhibits, set the various scenes. What is incredible is that the story of Dior began here, Crinière says, echoing a sentiment shared by her colleagues that the museum couldn't be built anywhere else. The exhibit opens with a spiral staircase, ascending in front of a three-story glass enclosure that displays a rainbow of more than 1,800 3D-printed miniature Dior pieces. The idea was how to go up without getting boring, Crinière explains. With this big colorama, people get surprised and understand that they are going to something very special. The origins of Dior's luxury house are presented elsewhere through original sketches, early press clippings, and the charts of fabric swatches Dior used to plan his collections. Past and present are intertwined in multiple rooms, two filled with floral motif gowns designed by various creative directors serve as homage to Dior's love of flowers. A recreation of the backstage area where models prepared for shows, which resembles a cabin, is visible through glass flooring. There are odes to the Miss Dior fragrance and Dior's days as a gallerist, when he displayed works by Picasso, Man Ray, and Dali. Videos dedicated to each creative director play in a loop in one space, and another highlights some of the house's most famous garments. The Bohan-designed gold lamé gown Lauren Hutton wore in the French film Tout Feu, Tout Flamme, the navy Galliano slip Princess Diana donned for the 1996 Met Gala, a playful nod to scandal just after her divorce from Prince Charles. A space dedicated to Dior's savoir-faire has duos from various departments of the atelier demonstrating their skills in real time. There are those really beautiful moments where we have an apprentice who's in her 20s. And then, next to her, somebody who's in their 60s and spent 40 years at Dior, Starkman says. The gallery welcomes over 1,000 visitors each day, she adds. You hear a lot of languages when you walk through the museum, Starkman says. Of course, you will have fashionistas, students in fashion, all the people that you expect to have in a fashion exhibition. But there's also a much wider audience. Next photos, Room with a View. The Room of Wonders features accessories from the archive, along with more miniature gowns. Dubbed the Heart of Creation, the cabin is where models prepared for shows, held in-house for decades. And the 1947 Haute Couture fashion show of the Corolle line, and the premiere of the Bar Suite. As La Galerie Dior was being built, the adjoining flagship boutique was revamped to include two eateries, a patisserie and Le Restaurant Monsieur Dior, three gardens, and various other trappings, like a dedicated haute couture salon and towering rose sculpture by Isa Genskin. Every day, we have people queuing in front of the boutique, Starkman says, not necessarily to go in and buy something, but just for the experience. Beccari likens it to the anti-metaverse. You must come here and feel these emotions, he says. This was apparent during a springtime visit to the boutique. Outside, a line of house enthusiasts and curious tourists awaited entry behind a Dior-branded partition. Inside, a group of women pored over thread colors in a space dedicated to customizing shoes and bags. Upstairs, diners partook in Dior's favorite recipes, as envisioned by chef Jean Imbert. Everyone, everywhere, was snapping photos of the meticulously landscaped roof, of cappuccinos topped with foamy cinnamon Dior logos, and lots of selfies. I told my staff the other day that I would like someone to leave here with a Dior tattoo, Beccari says, of the museum and boutique, meaning they liked it so much that not only do they not forget, maybe it's a dress they don't forget, or La Galerie Dior, or the Restaurant Monsieur Dior, where they had a great meal, but that they'll have something that reminds them of Dior. When Chiuri was offered the creative director role in 2016, she could hardly believe it. At the time, she was co-creative director of Valentino, alongside Pierpaolo Piccioli, having previously worked at Fendi. At first, I was torn, but then I came to realize that this was a challenge that I could not and should not walk away from, she says. Since then, the Rome-born Chiuri has sought to design for women whose wardrobes call for not just elegance and allure, but practicality. This approach means more T-shirts, denim, and sneakers, though the house's ultra-feminine codes still exist by way of full skirts, corset bodices, and embroidered tulle gowns. Both Turi and Jones have collaborated with contemporary artists such as Judy Chicago and Amuaka Boafo, and their interpretations of Bohan's oblique print and Galliano's saddlebag are among reissues helping Dior grow profits year after year. According to Vogue Business, the house clocked an estimated $7 billion in sales in 2021, up from a reported $4.6 billion in 2019. What I am most proud of is having succeeded in giving shape to a contemporary femininity capable of reconciling the demands of feminism with an idea of fashion that is at the service of women, says Turi, and also to have shown a light, thanks to the communicative power of Dior, on artist, activist, and theorist committed to women day in and day out. Now I'm coming to realize that I've done a good job, thanks to the recognition I get. Of course, I don't feel smug about it. There is still a lot of work to be done, but this motivates me to go on. Bikari likewise says he aims not to just sell products, but to tell a story through them. Projects like the renovation of 30 Montaigne are central to that vision, even if they aren't the safest bet. I think you must put a bit of chaos into the business, he says, take risk and be provocative, because repeating the same thing isn't going to lead to success. Though Turi feels there's perhaps too much talk about fashion and time, the feat of Dior remaining a paradigm of luxury fashion for 75 years is not lost on her. When a brand is solid because its vision is authentic, it withstands the test of time, she says. It endures because it knows how to read contemporaneity through the sensitivity of all its creative directors and of all the artisans who make the magic happen. In this sense, Dior is an extraordinary example of the communicative and cultural power of fashion. It knows how to speak about all of us. It knows how to speak to today. scene stealer. For years, a Grey's Anatomy writer spilled her personal traumas in online essays and wove the details into the show's plot, until a surprising email to Shondaland accused her of making it all up. And that's not even the most shocking part of The True Lies of Elizabeth Finch by Evgenia Peretz, with the illustration by Kinsuke Koike, which shows a woman's face in horizontal segments, and the segments are not lined up so that the face is quite distorted. In February 2014, television writer Elizabeth Finch wrote about her diagnosis of chondrosarcoma, a rare and usually fatal form of bone cancer, in an Elle magazine article that seemed tailor-made for TV. Not only did the writer have a harrowing personal story, currency in Hollywood, her dialogue had a dramatic punch. The doctor said, "There's something we need to discuss, chondrosarcoma. I've never seen anything like this, especially in someone your age. Nothing about this is going to be easy." Finch was a feisty woman in a man's world, and she channeled the doctor nicknaming conventions of a certain hit medical TV show. When I defied Dr. Kryptik's orders to take an indefinite leave of absence from work, he thought chemo deserved my sole attention. He doubted my commitment to getting well. And when it came to work, she was a writer on the Vampire Diaries, she was unstoppable. I watched the producer's cuts under a fog of Demerol, punched up dialogue about vampire-werewolf hybrids with a shunt in my spine. Yes, I was down 17 pounds, bald, vomiting relentlessly, but I was still living alone, still stubborn as hell. Shortly after the article's publication, a development executive at Shondaland, the production company of writer-producer powerhouse Shonda Rhimes, presented Finch to the showrunner of Grey's Anatomy, then in its 10th season, as a potential hire. The writer soon met with Rhimes herself. Everyone involved had been impressed with the Elle article. At the end of the meeting, Rhimes offered the young woman her dream job. Less than 5 years later, a version of Finch's cancer story was beamed around the world to millions of Grey's Anatomy viewers. Anybody Have a Map is one of 13 episodes that Finch wrote and one of 172 that she produced. The setting is an upscale bar. Tom Karakik, the cocksure star surgeon played by Greg German, has just learned the likely diagnosis of his friend and fellow surgeon Catherine Avery, played by the fabulous Debbie Allen, Finch's avatar. "Chondro is a beast," he tells her, referring to chondrosarcoma. "We know it's deadly serious because he's dropped his jocular shtick. Doesn't respond to chemo, so if you're lucky, and it's a big if, we may be able to cut it out without making me a quadriplegic," Catherine interrupts, "which means I'll never operate again." The pressure is on Tom. Yes, he's the best there is. But, as he later confides to Dr. Meredith Grey, Ellen Pompeo, on a street corner, "I have no idea how to remove it without killing or paralyzing her." Elizabeth as Debbie, as Catherine, isn't having it. She tells them to go get their asses in gear to save her and delivers a speech about her tenacity. "I survived losing my mother before I could even get to know her, and my father, who dropped dead on his way to church when I was 18 years old. I raised my sisters alone, no help, no money. I have survived racism, sexism, every ism designed to make me feel small and make me less. If I can do all of that, if I can survive all of that, then I just might survive this too. But I can't do this on my own, so I need you to figure it out, fast. Excuse me, I have to go call my husband." Moments later, there's a wrap-up kernel of wisdom spoken in voiceover by her husband, Dr. Richard Weber. played by James Pickens Jr. The problem with all the how-tos, step-by-step books, they don't take into account the exceptions to the rules. They never leave room for the outliers, the geniuses, the miracles. Everyone in Finchie's world, as they called her, believed she was that miracle. Not only was chondrosarcoma unheard of in someone her age, but she was, incredibly, living with it since 2012. In fact, she was the only one in her clinical trial who survived. She showed up so bravely to the Gray's Anatomy writer's room, a scarf over her bald head, and she so inspired everyone around her that they did whatever they could to support. Her bosses gave her all the time off she needed to participate in her maintenance chemo and clinical trials at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. Friends there drove her to and from appointments. When cancer storylines came up on the show, Finch led the way. She was the expert. And she even chronicled her experience with chondrosarcoma on the side, in Elle and The Hollywood Reporter, and on Shondaland.com to promote her episodes. She wasn't one to draw attention to herself. No, cancer, alas, had become her brand. Other terrible things seemed to befall Finch, some of which she chronicled for the world, some of which she talked about in select company. Against all medical odds, due to her cancer treatments, she became pregnant. She faced the awful dilemma of aborting the fetus or dying if she wanted to carry it, because she'd have to cease treatment. She chose to have an abortion. There was the kidney transplant she needed due to something cancer-related. A dear friend was killed in the Tree of Life synagogue massacre in Pittsburgh, where Finch went to college, and she helped clean the friend's remains off the floor. The FBI allowed it. Her brother, Finch was realizing in midlife, had abused her many years ago. Then he took his own life. Well, not quite. He was so vindictive that he was intentionally unsuccessful. And Finchie was the one who had to pull the plug. She was the Job of the Disney lot. Then, in February of this year, just as Rhymes was dropping the splashy first release she created under her Netflix deal, Inventing Anna, about con artist Anna Delvey, she received an email on her private account. It was from an unlikely sender, Jennifer Beyer, a struggling mother of five from Kansas, and a registered nurse who had married Finch in 2020, though they were by now estranged. And its message was not just unlikely, but unthinkable. Finch, Beyer wrote, had been telling stories, and it was time to stop believing her. Rhymes knew of Beyer. She had even advised Finch about matters concerning the couple's future together and Beyer's kids. But this time, Rhymes did not respond and did not respond. If what Beyer was saying was true, Rhymes and all of Shondaland had been Delveyed, as had Finch's friends and family members. Only she wasn't stealing people's money. She was taking their empathy and tears, as well as other people's personal traumas, which she would call her own. In response to detailed questions for Finch regarding information from multiple sources, her attorney, Andrew Brettler, contended that not all of Beyer's claims were true and asserted that Beyer was neither reliable nor unbiased because the two women are in the midst of a highly contentious divorce. People close to Finch, from the distinct compartments of her life, have been grappling with the idea that the woman they loved may not exist. Those who've known Finch the longest have looked back at her young life for clues. At least from the outside, Finch's early life seems fairly normal. She grew up in a middle-class Jewish family in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. She was bat mitzvahed, went to Jewish summer camp, attended Cherry Hill East High School. It had a strong theater department, and she wrote plays that people appreciated. She was sharp and funny and spunky. She made lasting friendships with smart, warm people. She had an older brother, Eric. Her mother, Joan, was a special education teacher. Her father, Robert, had a less solid career, according to a source close to the family, but she was loved. In her early adulthood, Finch was surrounded by cancer for real. While she was in college at Carnegie Mellon, her mother was diagnosed with cancer. She learned all about what went into that. 5 years into her mother's diagnosis, as Finch later wrote, "Our family were all experts in pharmacology, wig design, hip hospital lingo, and fashioning surreptitious means of throwing up in public places." Her mother survived. After a stint at USC Film School, Finch worked as an assistant to television writer Rick Cleveland. When Cleveland's mother got sick with stage 4 lung cancer, she went out of her way to do research for him. Then, when Cleveland's close friend's wife got breast cancer, she was helpful to him and his family. "Minch is the word I would use to describe her," wrote Cleveland in an email, bristling at the suggestion that she could have been untruthful. He introduced her to Alan Ball, creator of True Blood, and she got her first job as a junior TV writer. During that period, Finch wrote about cancer publicly for the first time, for a personal essay site called Fresh Yarn. After it was clear her mother would survive, she herself took the test for the BRCA gene mutation, she wrote, and it came back positive. "The fat doctor, I could tell, wanted me to cry, but I didn't." The line was typical of what would become a hallmark of her style. "Dr. Man dumb, me brave." The piece is bookended by a dramatic cliffhanger when Finch, rattled by the thought of getting cancer, gets into a car crash. "Officer Frank tells me I'm lucky I'm not dead." As part of IAMA, a theater group in L.A., she wrote another personal trauma into a play, Return to Sender, about an ex-military guy who suffers from PTSD and stalks his girlfriend. She told a friend it was based on herself and an ex-boyfriend. In 2012, she landed a writing job on The Vampire Diaries, earning the joke nickname Vampire Girl. According to a writer on the show, she was meek in the room, barely said a word. This was a rough atmosphere, with writers routinely fearing they'd end up on the chopping block. Shortly thereafter is when Finch herself got cancer, or so she claimed. Not breast or ovarian cancer, but this rare and more fatal bone cancer, which was discovered after alleged knee replacement surgery. The tumor in her spine had grown so big that surgery risked paralysis, she wrote, so it required chemotherapy right away. Her closest relative at the time was an older cousin in New Jersey who considered Finch a younger sister. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock, Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock, Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.